to other participants. Now we're ready to begin tonight's session, and I'm delighted to introduce our guest, Mrs. Tzipora Shack. Tzipora Shack is a school psychologist from Rockland County, New York. She is dedicated to helping children find success during the school day and beyond through her work with teachers, principals, parents, and children. She holds two master's degrees, one in special education and one in school psychology, as well as having completed extensive postgraduate work in administration. After working for the New York City Department of Education, she assumed the role of director of the Learning Center at the Beth Ruchel School in Muncie, as well as founding Pathways Consulting Services, LLC, a professional development agency. She has served as the permanent educational consultant for many schools in Muncie over the last decade and presents trainings throughout the country. Mrs. Shack is also an adjunct faculty instructor for Mercy College, teaching in both the undergraduate and graduate programs of special education and psychology. From all her responsibility, she most enjoys her counseling and coaching sessions with children and teens, giving them the cognitive, linguistic, social, and emotional tools they need to succeed in the real world. I am also delighted tonight to introduce our co-facilitator, Betsy Kane, who will be working with Tzipora. Welcome, Tzipora and Betsy. And Tzipora, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I'd like to welcome everybody tonight, and thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedules to explore a topic that I think is going to be helpful to you in your classrooms. Betsy, just a quick question. I can click now to advance?
Yes, you can.
Okay. So what we're going to talk about tonight is kind of to answer the question, have you ever wondered why some students and adults seem to have great difficulty organizing their tasks, their time, and their things, and others do it effortlessly? One answer that I'm going to try to offer is that we all have varied profiles of executive function strengths and weaknesses. So I'd like to spend the time tonight looking at what some of these executive functions are and what we can do about them if we need to strengthen them. Our goals tonight are to list executive functions using two models, one the Russell Barclay model and two the Guari and Dawson model. I'd like to look at the overlap between learning disabilities, ADHD, and weaknesses in executive functioning. I'd like to talk about how a coach can provide intervention and support services during the school day, and I'd like teachers to learn some practical strategies for some of these executive functions, for helping them out. So to get started tonight, I'd like to ask a quick question. If you heard the term executive functions, how do you think it's related to schools? And I'm going to read the four questions, and by a raise of hand after each question, let me know if you're agreeing with that answer. So one, executive functions are meetings that board members and principals attend. Anybody thinking that that's what we're talking about tonight, executive functions? Okay, no hands. Kids that are barely functioning due to disorganization make you want to execute them. Any hands? Out and see a lot of hands there. I don't know how my school would function without our executive director. And number four, I tuned in today to find out the answer. Any hands? So executive functions, if we have to give it a quick and easy definition, would be cognitive processes that regulate an individual's ability to execute daily life. And in simple English, it's the things we do every day to get it done. So according to Russell Barclay, that list includes the ability to inhibit our behavior, to kind of stop ourselves from doing things or saying things we shouldn't do, using our memory, adding things to it, shifting things around in our memory, thinking ahead to a situation, like if I'm going to throw that spitball at my teacher, I wonder what's going to happen. And combining that with hindsight, last time I did that, I was suspended. Not a good idea. Inhibit. So actually using those three together. Organization, which includes organizing both your things, supplies, school items and also your ideas. Self-talk. And I used to think I was the only one that did self-talk, kind of, you know, standing in the kitchen and working on something and speaking out loud. Some of the time it's actually going on in your head. Some of the time it's going on, you know, verbally and others could hear it. But walking yourself and talking yourself through your tasks, a sense of time, which has to do with planning, thinking if I have 3 days to get this done, when do I need to start? What should I parcel out for each of those days? Shifting agendas, which is an easy way to understand that is really transitioning, so transitioning from subject to subject, transitioning from task to task, and transitioning from idea to idea. And the last one is separating emotions from facts, so that ability to think clearly and see clearly why things are making us upset. In 2009, Guari and Dawson expanded that list. Some of the items remain the same, and some of the items shifted a little bit. So the first is response inhibition, again, that ability to inhibit, working memory, the same, emotional control, you understand that. Sustained attention is what they added to their list. That ability to keep interested in something even when it's kind of lost interest. Task initiation, getting started on something you know you need to do. Planning and prioritizing. What do I need to do first? What's the main thing that has to happen here? Again, organizing ideas and things, time management. Goal-directed persistence. What do I have to do to get this job done? What are distractors for me, and how am I going to jump those hurdles of the distractors? Flexibility, which is very similar to shift, and metacognition, which is similar to self-talk, thinking about what we're doing. Where are all these executive functions happening? So when we want to think about it, we really think it is in their heads. Babies are born with brains weighing an average of about 13 ounces, and over the course of their childhood, their brains are going to actually end up weighing 3 pounds. So huge, huge growth in brain tissue. And the type of brain tissue gets divided into gray matter and white matter, and we used to think that gray matter and white matter both are finished their growth by about age 5 or 6. And that kind of correlated to a lot of learning opportunities, you know, ideal years for, you know, first language and second language learning. And we realized while that is true, that much of the brain has grown by age 6, there's another really big growth spurt right before puberty. And what happens is gray matter is related to cognitive processes, and white matter is related to executive functions. And the brain says, whichever you're using a lot of, we're going to keep that, and whatever you're not using a lot of, we're going to prune away. So we really need to attend to that white matter and have children work with it if they're not so strong with it so it doesn't get pruned. The ideal stage for if we're going to modify it at all is that growth spurt right before adolescence. And the place that it's occurring in is the frontal lobe. And we know that the frontal lobe is what directs behavior and what links past behaviors with current ones. Most individuals have an array of executive skill strengths as well as executive skill weaknesses. We know that, but we still need to figure out which weaknesses a child has so we can figure out which interventions will be most helpful to them. If we see a child doing any of these tasks, planning, organizing, keeping their supplies neat, remembering, and they do it some of the time, but they don't do it all of the time, that usually speaks to a weakness. Somebody that has a weakness doesn't have the inability to do something altogether. They just aren't able to do it as consistently as they need to. And if a child has a strength in a certain area, they're able to do this, we want to look at what skills were involved so we could figure out how to get them to do it more of the time. There is this overlap piece on your three-circle Venn where we have executive function weaknesses, learning disabilities, and ADHD. And the role of the teacher is certainly not diagnostic. I'm not asking you to look at students and kind of figure out what's wrong with them. But if you know that a child has some learning disabilities, that is going to tell you that there's a part of their difficulty that has to do with executive function. If a child does have ADHD, there is a part of that, a very big part, in fact, that has to do with executive functioning. But a child can also have poor executive functioning and not have a learning disability and not have ADHD. I'm going to divide executive functions for tonight's presentation into two parts, part one and part two. Part one are what I call the doing executive functions, and part two, excuse me, are the thinking executive functions. The doing ones that we're going to be working with are time planning, organization, shift, and self-talk. And while foresight, hindsight, inhibition, memory, and separating emotions is very, very important, I'm not going to be able to cover ABS for that tonight. Common challenges, and the challenges do shift as well. In the early elementary grades, I would say about grades 1 through 4, getting started on a task is really difficult. Organizing papers, supplies, desks, inhibition, and shifting and transitioning. When we get to middle school, we have a much greater need to be masters of time management, to plan, to prioritize, to organize our things, and to use foresight and hindsight. When we know a student has executive skill weaknesses, what we want to do is also look at emotional responses and behavioral responses. A lot of times we'll see what we formerly would call lack of motivation or frustration. And we have to ask ourselves, is that related to whether or not they can handle this task? When a child is avoiding, why are they avoiding? Is there something about this task that they can't do? And let's now look at that task. What executive skills were involved? Did they need to organize? Did they need to order? Did they need to plan? Did they need to initiate? And if we can assist them with that, then maybe the task will become doable. In order to figure out what needs a child has, the first thing we want to do is look at their whole schedule, really starting for whatever part of the day you have them, whether it's the morning, whether it's the afternoon, and kind of make a list of the time frame, the subject, and the activity, and write down where you see them struggling. I see them struggling during math. I see them struggling during packing away their homework. I see them struggling during making that shift from Hebrew studies, Judaic studies, to English studies, and then figure out what needs to be addressed. And who could best help the child? Is it the classroom teacher, himself or herself? Is there a mentor, a Title I personnel that could come in and work with the child? Is there somebody that works in the function of coach in schools? Is it something that a parent could help the child with? Can we pass on some of this responsibility to peers in the class? Or can the child be responsible for themselves? Where and when are we going to support this child? Some of you may have just said to yourself, well, what do you mean a coach? A coach in our school, we have a coach for the baseball team, we have a coach for the basketball team, how are they helping out? So in 1830 in Oxford University, the term coach kind of came into existence, and it really was meant to describe a tutor who carried a student through exams, and that sounds a lot like cramming to me. 1831, that term coach was applied to the leader of the cricket team, so we made our entry into the sports world, and the rest is history. And it wasn't until, I would say, the early 1990s that term coaching moved solely away from sports and into the business and psychology models. If you review the literature, that's where you will start seeing it, an ADHD coach, a life coach, a business coach. And a coach supports individuals through a process of achieving a specific and a personal result. The coach really wants this individual to succeed. They help them figure out which of their strengths are going to guide them towards the success and what they need to do about weaknesses that are going to distract or detract from it. And it's a skill-based learning experience. Ooh, we skipped one, sorry. What the coach is going to do is think of a plan. Think of a set of directions that's going to go along with this plan. They're going to monitor performance. They're going to say, how is this going? How are you doing with this? Is this getting easier? Is this getting better for you? They're going to provide support. Wow, you're really working towards this goal. That looked great. This is still hard for you. Let's strategize and let's problem solve what we can do about that. This is a challenge. You know, let's see what other options we have. And they're also going to determine when mastery is reached, it looks like you can do this all on your own now, and I don't need to help you with this. And the most important piece is they celebrate these type of accomplishments. So the ideal coach is really a parent or a teacher, because that's going to happen at the point of performance. Both of those people are going to be there more often than somebody stepping in just once a day. How do you start coaching a student? And I know those of you that are classroom teachers, I was one myself, you're thinking, there is no way I have extra time to do this. You know, this kid, as it is taking up so much of my time. So that kind of thinking reminds me of an old Hungarian expression, and I certainly can't spell it or even pronounce it in Hungarian, but it's spend a lot, cry once. Spend a little, cry a lot, which really meant when you purchase something that costs a lot, you know, the pain of parting with your money happens once, but when you purchase inferior things that maybe were cheaper, you keep crying because it never really works out the way you need it to. And I found that when you invest time, and that's what I'm talking about, spending time. So when you spend some initial time setting up a coaching system with a child, setting up a plan, setting up some scaffolding, yeah, it is going to take some of your time. It's going to take some of your thinking and planning time outside school, and it's even going to take some of your time inside school. But if you can lead this child to success, you will free up time from them the rest of the year. And if not, I can almost guarantee you, unfortunately, that you're going to be spending time and time again. And that time is also going to be very frustrating both for you and the child. So allot some time. Do your homework. Think about it. And when you're going to start working with the student, you're going to tell them openly and honestly with a real sense of transparency what you're going to be doing. Kids are really such accurate reporters, and they're also really aware of their challenges. So you say, you know, I noticed that some things are hard for you in the afternoon. You know, can you share with me what you think some of those things are? And most of the time, they're going to hit right on the list that you had in mind. And you're going to have this in a really calm conversation. There's not going to be other children nearby, so it might be at a recess time, before school, after lunch. You know, you can even bring some snacks for this discussion. But the time to strategize about what you're going to do in the future is not when, you know, they're standing by their desk and everything's on the floor, or they're handing in, you know, they're coming up and they're saying, I can't hand in my report because I don't have a book yet. And, you know, that's not the time to forward strategize. You're going to be really empathic. This is not about a chart. This is not about behavior modification. This is not about punishment. This is about me really helping you do something that you really want to do. You're going to remind the child about the benefits. It's going to be so much easier if you're organized. It's going to save you some time. You're going to have more time to do what you want to do. You're going to listen to the child because they have a lot of ideas about what will and what won't work for them. You're going to be really positive. Some children are really down on themselves by this point. I can't. There's no way I can do this. It's never worked before. You're going to teach them and model how to do the skill that you want them to do, and you're going to feedback constantly over time as they're practicing that skill. I'm going to go through a couple ideas and concepts, and you can adapt from there. The first one is actually one that we suggest to parents, and if you have a child coming into school without a lot of their things, oh, I left my homework at home, oh, I need to call my mother, I left my lunch at home, oh, you know, oh, I don't have the pencils, or they're late because they were still looking for things. You know, what we really think is a great school day begins at home. It doesn't begin when they walk into your classroom. So the easiest idea we have for children that have organization problems is just a plastic box, one of those Rubbermaid bins right near the front door, and literally everything they need for the morning is placed in it. So it's not only their book bag that's packed with the homework, but it's their shoes, their coat, their snack, their lunch. It's like one-stop shopping for them in the morning. So sometimes we are working so hard on getting the folders back in the book bag and getting things that they need, and they waste their time in the morning looking for the other shoe or the mittens or things like that. The next thing we want to go to, and we're kind of working outwards and inwards, is we want to look at their book bags. And it's interesting, there's a neuropsychologist that I'm friendly with, that I also refer a lot of children to them for testing. And one of the questions he routinely asks the parents is, can you describe your child's book bag to me? Tell me what it looks like. And many children that are struggling with this, their parents will say, oh my, it's exploding. It's lunch from 2 weeks ago and some crumpled up papers that were tests that needed to be signed and PTA notice that I got a week late, and what they really need is not in it, and what they don't need stays there forever. So you're going to make a schedule if organizing is the task that you're going to be coaching, and 2 to 3 times a week you're going to say, we're going to just dump everything out of this. Let's go through every piece of things and every item that's in here, and let's put it in a place. What goes in what folder, what do you need in here, what can be recycled, what needs to stay in school and what needs to stay at home. You're going to repack it. You're going to be talking through this questioning, and you're going to, at a certain point, let them assume more of the responsibility. So you're going to ask, you can even make a checklist on a card, do I need this? If yes, where does it belong? If no, where does it go? And kind of ask them that initially until they start doing that on their own. What usually happens is they start doing it on their own and you say, oh, great, you know, I'm done with this job. And the next week they're not on their same schedule. And by a week later, the buildup is back. So really getting them into almost writing on their planner what days are book bag cleaning days. The next thing we're going to move towards is organizing the desk. And the easiest way is, it can be a desk or it can be a cubby or it can even be a locker, is you're going to make a photo card or a layout card, because most teachers like certain things in the desk and certain things not in the desk. And from those things, they kind of go on different sides. So maybe their sitter and their chumash go on one side and their pencil box and their loose leaf goes on the other side. Once a week, you're going to say, we're making Pesach in this desk. We're really cleaning it out. There's nothing that's getting hidden in the back. Every now and then, you're going to take a quick peek into it and say, oh, does that belong there? Where's that supposed to go? Things we want to keep inside are what we call high-frequency items. They're things that they're used every day. If there's an item that the teacher really is not using, maybe she's using it once or twice a week, we want to figure out where else can that child keep it, because, you know, a buildup or accumulation is not going to be helpful. One item that I've noticed that we actually use in our resource room for all the children grades 3 and below, it's called a kangaroo pouch. I think School Specialty sells them. It's like this huge pocket that fits over the back of the chair, and it has 2 sections in it, and it just creates additional storage space that's really close to the child, so they kind of reach behind them and pull out, you know, some other items. One school I work in actually did as a sewing project. Some of the mothers came in and ordered burlap and sewed them up. But if not, I think they're about $9, $10 a piece, and they work really well. The next thing we want to go to is organizing their binders or their, you know, the books, their loose leaves. There's certainly going to be one folder that has 2 pockets, and one pocket is going to be recycle it, which is, you know, the politically correct word for take it home and throw it out. Or, and one side of the folder is going to be please return this to school. It's best to have just one divider, and if you have a dual curriculum, so one divider for Judaic studies and one for general studies. We want to have a planner, and I'm not going to go into the whole idea of a planner now. You can reference the study skill archives for how to use a planner, but we want a planner becomes a to-do list every day. This is what I have to do and check off. And a planner also has space for a week at a glance or a month at a glance, so I can kind of think ahead and break down what else I need to do. I try to color match things also. So if there's a red math workbook, then I try to pick a red folder for the math pages or a red spiral. If you have a blue book cover, you want to pick a blue. So as soon as the children see the color, they say, oh, that belongs with this subject, not that they're constantly looking inside and seeing. Another idea to help on that organization is there are certain books that the children don't write in the book, let's say like a math book, but they're opening it up to do the problem. So for a child that's really struggling with disorganization, we want to lend them a double book, so one stays in school and one stays at home, so I don't have to worry that it's getting lost in transit. And another idea is really an identical set of texts, which is a little bit different. And I'm going to get to that question in a minute because it's an excellent one, is whatever text they're using, so if they're using a certain style of Chumash or a certain brand of Navi, we want to have the same at home so the child doesn't lose time trying to figure out where they're working and that it should look exactly the same. So the question is, a child who comes from a house that lacks organization and responsibility doesn't have that as a model. And that is so true. And those students are in all of our classes. How do you explain this to the child without putting down the house, yet still making sure to teach him these skills and the importance of them? So that's an excellent idea. Thank you, Julie, that she, you also photocopy pages that they won't need, which is a nice idea. I just find that sometimes the risk with the photocopying is then they lose the sheet. Not as costly as losing the book, but it does happen. So to get back to that first question, I don't even think we have to bring the home, you know, into it. We're not social workers and we're not doing a home visit. We're not doing an inspection. What we really say is, you can explain it even with your own reference. You know, I'm a teacher. And what are some of the things that I need to do to really teach well? I need to plan my lessons at home. I need to bring my supplies in. I need to come on time. If I'm giving a test, I have to remember to give it into the office for Xeroxing the day before. If I want to put up a lesson on my smart board, I have to have it loaded into the computer and ready to go. And what I'd like to do is help you, you know, Maishi, David, Chaya, Eva, whatever the students' names, I'd like to help you get organized for what we need to do here. I wouldn't even reference the home unless they say, well, my mother doesn't help me with this, or I never have this, in which case, you know, sometimes you can call a parent and say, you know, I see Chaya struggling with this, and I thought of these ideas. Again, we're not asking what's going on in the home, and it's not our job to fix what's going on. We just need to guide whatever needs to happen in order for the student to be successful. Does that answer your question? The next thing that I want to talk about is shifting and transitioning. For some students, they get stuck on one part of the day and they never get to the rest. Too many things need to happen sometimes in a short period of time. So the first idea is an embedded schedule, which we'll get to on the next slide, and a to-do list. And that's kind of all the things I need for my morning routine, all the things I need to get through packing up. But I'll get to that soon. The next point about shifting is that a child might be very, very engrossed in his or her activity, and you're saying, okay, please put away your math books and get ready for history, and they just can't. They really just can't because they have three more problems to do. And whether they heard you or not, it's usually a question of they didn't hear you, and then when you said it a third time or a fourth time, they still need to finish because they're not ready to move on to what they wanted to do with them. So a couple things to do is really to speak to them to say, you know, I'm seeing you're struggling, and what's happening is when the rest of the class is moving on, and you're still there, you're getting a late start on the next thing, and you're kind of getting yourself into this situation where you're always behind. So what I'm going to do is 5 minutes before I'm going to ask people to put away or to pack up or to shift, I'm going to give you a little warning. Either yourself, hi, in 5 minutes we're going to be doing this, but usually I tell the whole class in 5 minutes, you know, 5 minutes left to this or 5 minutes before. For a lot of children, especially those with anxiety, it kind of settles them. Now I know what's coming next. Some older kids can kind of set a little alarm on their cell phone that vibrates. There are watches you can order that you can preset intervals or times, and it will vibrate against the child's wrist. I believe they cost about $40, $50. They're from ADHD Warehouse. What we really want to encourage is not always finishing everything completely, but do a job that's good enough and do your personal best. We're really not after having perfect work in school. We'd rather have, in many cases, quantity, getting through what we need to get through in the morning, than just pure quality, only working on one task. before you're going to start this type of thing with either warnings or, you know, using a personal timer, you want to rehearse this. You want to say to the child, what words do you want me to use when I'm reminding you? You know, that's that verbal prompt. And do a role play with this. During the time, it can be a visual or a nonverbal also. So you might have a clock on the board and you might just tap against it, or you might put up a little note on the board coming next, or you might be making a check next to your schedule, your daily schedule that's on the board. Once you start to see this child shift and move on, you really want to praise them, because this is something that wasn't easy for them to do, and you want to talk about what helped them. You want to debrief on it. Schedules and to-do lists. So the first is called an embedded schedule, and I use embedded schedules for younger children. I would say grades 1, 2, and 3. What I do is I list all the activities. So if it's a child in a house and it's all the things they need to do to get ready from the time they wake up until they go to school, or from the time their mother says, please prepare for bed, we list all those activities. We either use clip art or we take a picture of the child doing that activity successfully, laying out their clothes, going, you know, gathering their pajamas, putting out their Nagel Voss or whatever it is. I laminate the card. I usually don't have more than about 8 to 10 activities. So in school, it might look like for a morning routine, hang up your coat, put your book bag on the hook, take out your chumash, put it into your desk, put your homework folder on the side of your desk, open up your sitter, and make sure you have 3 sharpened pencils. You laminate the card. You give the child each day a paperclip that starts at the top. And I know recently Staples has all these supplies and open bins, and they have these really funky, large stripes and polka-dotted paperclips. And the child moves down that list themselves. When they are on task and on schedule, they hand you back that paperclip. They've done all those, and the paperclips get collected and traded for a prize, usually after 5 paperclips or 10 paperclips. For older students, we're not going to use a picture chart, but we're definitely going to teach them how to use a to-do list. And it might be the same type of to-do list every day, certain things they need to do, or it can be a wipe-off board, a mini whiteboard, and they write things. If it's the same list, what I do is I do it as a tear-off. So it's pre-printed, and it's kind of, you know, put into a little pad. And each day when they're done, they date it. And instead of putting a paper clip in my jar or in my bin, they just hand that list in with their signature at the bottom to show that they completed all of it. You know, they're handing it in as a voucher. And the same thing, the vouchers then add up to something later. The idea of an embedded schedule or a to-do list is you kind of lay out what has to be done, but you're not the nag at each one. You know, you walk them through the process a number of times, and you're checking if they need support. But the goal is once the list is laid out, the child starts moving themselves through it. Self-talk, you know, how do we get kids to talk in their heads? So the first thing is we model. So if we're standing in front of our desk and it's getting ready for the end of the day, we might say, ooh, I have to remember to send my copies to the office. I have to remember to turn off the lights and the air conditioner. And yes, class, the janitor asked us to please stack our chairs on the desk. So things that we would be thinking, we start to say out loud. And the things are usually related to organizing. I make myself oral lists. Okay, we're going to go to lunch, and when we're at lunchtime, Chaya, remind me to speak to Mrs. Davidson, and Shlomo, remind me to stop in the office and pick up the colored paper. So we do those oral lists. I ask children to repeat instructions and directions. So when I say it once, I ask somebody else, who else can tell us, you know, tell us what we need to do now? I use ordinal numbers. So first, we're going to be doing this. Second, we're going to be doing that. And third, or I use sequence words. First, then, next, last. I also use numbers. Number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4. So children have a way of counting on the things they needed to do. I cue them. And what we really found is the more external self-talk you're going to model, the more they get the idea of this is going to move to eventual silent internal talk. So you really need to be in the position of doing this. Reinforcement. all of these things are really hard to do. They're really hard to change. I think I have it on one of these slides. As adults, we have completely organized our life to the maximum, you know, way possible, that the executive functions we're strong in, we really use a lot. And those that we're weak in, we try to get as much help as possible because we know we need all of them working at a certain level. So when a child is really moving, you know, along this continuum of getting stronger, you're going to really praise them enthusiastically, specifically, and the most important thing, immediately, again, at that point of performance, we want to let them know that they're being reinforced. We always want to praise student effort, the fact that they're trying above the achievement. So the achievement doesn't have to be perfect, and it doesn't even have to be reached, but the fact that the child's trying, and we're noticing that, is certainly going to get a lot more trying in the future. A question that I get asked a lot is, well, if I'm going to be helping them and coaching them and even, you know, showing them constantly how to organize this or how to do that, isn't that a crutch? Aren't they ever going to learn it themselves? You know, how are we going to prepare them for the real world? And, you know, no one's going to be there all along singing out their desks. And some of those ideas really aren't that true, because I kind of think of it like the ABC chart that's on the first grade wall. So when I was in first grade and I needed to remember how to make a Q, and every time our teacher asked us to write clean, we definitely looked up and saw how we formed Q. But I was sitting in a first grade classroom today actually doing an observation, and I didn't need to look up at that chart of how to write the Q, because when I don't need it anymore, I'm not going to use it. So there's very few children that are going to want you involved in their planning and organizing and shifting when they don't need it anymore. And there are adults that have, like we said before, the executive functions that are hard for them. They have a lot of people help them with them, and they use those crutches. So that is like the last thing that I'm going to worry about, because I think that most children transition on their own when they're ready on their own timetable. How else do we reinforce something fun at the finish line? So when we finish our embedded schedules, when you hand in seven of them, when you hand in seven vouchers, plan a tangible, something the child can have, or an increased responsibility. You know, wow, you're being really organized with getting yourself packed up at night, or you're being really organized with getting everything into your book bag by the end of the day. You know, I'm going to be able to reward you with extra time for silent reading. I'm going to be able to reward you with 5 minutes extra of recess. You're going to pick the game for our whole class. You're going to get 10 minutes extra at bedtime because you're using your time so well. Privileges, crafts. You know, we do that a lot in some of the schools. We either pick a craft that the child will like than giving them something. And something cute is always a mystery activity or a mystery trip, you know, that they don't know about till the end. And like we said, as adults, we've outsourced and delegated many of these tasks, and children don't have that luxury, so really reinforce that effort. Some of you are thinking, okay, this is all very nice, but it's not about just her desk. It's her desk and her book bag and her homework folder, and she's late, and she's messy, and she's talky, and, you know, like, I need to be doing all of this, but that's not going to work. And we know ourselves when we try to change things about ourselves and there's too much going on, you know, nothing comes through. So pick one area and one area only. You know, the fact that all those are needs is not going to change. You know, and you can't handle it all at once. And my suggestion is not to pick the one that's most detrimental, you know, and that's really tempting. You know, if only her desk would be organized. I really want to pick the one that she's going to be the most successful with. Right, great. Thank you, Miriam Sarah. Start with the success. So really pick the easiest one, because once you have the child on board and they're feeling good about it, they're going to be able to much, you know, with a much greater sense of ease, handle something harder. View the support as a work in progress. So you're going to make your plan. And this is something you even need to communicate in that sense of transparency to the children. We're going to try this. But if you see that it's not working for you, or we need to add something in or take something away, we are definitely going to be changing this. Get feedback from everybody. So if you're the teacher, get feedback from the parents. Get feedback from the child. Get feedback from your partner teacher in the morning or the afternoon. If you're the parent, get feedback from everybody else. And if you ask me, how long should this take? You know, the answer is my classic, it depends. You know, this is going to take time. Rome wasn't built in a day. you're not thinking about starting and finishing. You're thinking about levels of support and levels of scaffolding, and you're really only looking at, you know, slowly shifting the levels of support, but we're not looking right now at the end goal. If you want to read more information about it, I think the three best sources that I can tell you about is one, Smart But Scattered, which is by Dawson and Guari, and they have just great ideas for children and for adults. The second is Kids in the Syndrome Mix, and by Dr. Martin Kutcher, who is a pediatric neurologist in Westchester and in Rockland County. This book is probably a required reading, or should be required reading, for so many parents and teachers. The only word of caution I tell you is don't read the whole book, because you'll see too many people that you know in it. And you're going to start thinking, oh, this one has this and this one has that. So if you're concerned about a child with executive function, read that chapter, but skip the one on bipolar. Or if you're concerned about, you know, some issues related to learning, read that chapter and skip the one on Asperger's. But really, it lays out the executive functions in a very clear and organized manner, and it also gives a lot of intervention strategies. And a children's book that I thought was fantastic, I ordered it from a website called Imagination Press, and that's imagination without the I. You know, it's not imagination. It's a publishing company, the publishing arm of the American Psychological Association, and they publish therapeutic books for children that are written by professionals. And in the back of each book is usually a guide for a teacher or parent or professional working with a child. So Annie's Plan is about an adorable little girl named Annie, who constantly says, ooh, tomorrow will be better, because Annie leaves her homework at home and leaves her homework in school and forgets everything. And Annie's constantly apologizing, but Annie's parents realize that she's really feeling so terrible about all of this, and they work with somebody, and Annie has a 5-point plan, and she really gets herself organized, and her parents are actually, some of the coaches involved. So it explains it to the child, and it gives a lot of good strategies. And the way that I would use this with a child is, if I would introduce the book to them, I would say, do you know this author, Jean Krauss? And most of the kids are going to say no. And I would say, does Jean Krauss know you? No. So I would say, so was this book written for you? No. I'd say, right, this book is written because a lot of children, this is something that's hard for them. And this lady has a lot of good ideas. So the first thing I would do with the book is really depersonalize it, and it seems to be more readily accepted. Where can you get the kangaroo pouch? Okay, I think that we ordered it from a school supply company called School Specialty. I believe there's a catalog and a website. So if you go online under School Specialty, you'd probably be able to find it, and if not, then just email me and I'll check our invoices at school where it's actually from. I've seen it in a few different forms, though. I've seen it in, like a primary color one. We have them in school that are royal blue, with red piping. I've also seen them like in a denim kind of burlap-y view, and they fit over every chair, which is really nice. Would I recommend reading such a book in a classroom setting? I'm kind of nervous to read, though, a book like that out loud, because I feel like a lot of the students are going to be kind of turning to the child whose desk is still exploding at that time, and they know that I'm reading it about him or about her. So if I was the coach and it was a younger student, I would read it with them, or I would offer it to the parent to read with them. But I don't know if I would read this unless I'm working with the whole class on specific organizational strategies. So if I would say our third grade or our sixth grade, we're working on time management, or we're working on shifting, or we're working on organized desks. If it was a project that I was doing with everybody, then I would. But if I'm going to be working just with one child, I don't want to read that book to everyone, because then that child thinks, great, now everybody knows. Rubrics. Please use rubrics. It's like the embedded list. Yeah, it definitely is. A rubric is really good for, helping them, and it's certainly good for grading. But the purpose of the embedded list, the only way I think that it's going to differ, and you can correct me if it's otherwise, is that my goal is not to assign value. My goal is to assign, chronology. So it's not a matter of how I want this job done. It's a matter of getting it done, and then what do I do next? So that's, I think, how rubrics would differ. It's been a pleasure. Yeah.
I just wanted to jump in because there is one more comment that sort of got lost. I think Julie was suggesting that the kangaroo pouch, a company called Really Good Stuff, has it.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Thank you. I have seen it. That is a great catalog in general, Really Good Stuff. Great little tools and shticks. Definitely have enhanced a lot of good reading instruction, wiki sticks, fly swatters that leave, you know, a certain visible in the middle so you can run it across the line. They just have really neat stuff in that book. But thank you. Somebody says they found
it. And yeah. Betsy.
Thank you, Betsy. So that's the link to finding the kangaroo pouch. I left my email at the end. You're more than welcome to contact me if you have questions. Obviously, I can't answer questions about specific children, but if there's a teaching idea that I can help you with, or if you need some further information, I'd be happy to guide you. I wish you a lot of luck and a lot of success. It's a long haul with executive function, so we really just want to know that we are leading a child. We're not going to finish with this by the time they get, you know, at the end of the year, but we're definitely going to leave them in a better place. Thank you so much. And any more questions?
Sipor, what I'm going to do is, you know what? Betsy is posting a couple of more links, I think. Okay. The Really Good Stuff link and schoolspecialty.com link. If people want to look in the chat room, they can copy those links if they'd like. I think what we're going to do now, Sipor, is I'm going to thank you and thank the participants, and then people, if they'd like to, we have time. If there are people who have specific questions, they can raise their hands when I let you know, and we will unmute your phones. I really want to extend such a heartfelt thank you, Tsipora. You took such an important topic, and not only did you break it down so that we have some of the theory and some of the practical, really fabulous suggestions, but you also scaffolded us in how to implement it. And I feel like some of these suggestions people can take and, you know, start doing tomorrow in their classrooms, but still keep in mind that one of the important pieces of the coaching process with these students is to keep doing it. And you really did such a great job of creating a whole circle for people to understand a lot of the needs in this area. So thank you so much for such an informative session.
You're so welcome. And thank you for hosting.
Oh, thank you. And to all the participants, thank you for your contributions. Up on the screen right now, everyone will see the upcoming webinars. What you need to do in order to register is just go to the Hidden Sparks Without Webs with the Hidden Sparks website, click on Hidden Sparks Without Walls, and you'll see the schedule there as well. And you click on the upcoming events that are interesting to you, and you can register at the website there. And the next one that's coming up is November 14th, Ecology of the Classroom with Kate Sussman, and then the next one will be on December 19th. And that is Temperament, Understanding Children's Preset Tendencies with Dr. Rona Novick. And then you can look on the schedule to see what's coming up. I just wanted to give people a heads up for these two that are the next ones. And Betsy, thank you so much for your wonderful technical abilities, as always. If people have – just remembered, you're going to get the survey in your email. Please fill it out. It really does help us, and we really want your reactions so that our program can reflect what it is that you need. And again, if you look in the chat box, Sipora, people are expressing all of their thanks to you. It was really a fabulous presentation. If there is anyone who is online and would like for their telephone to be unmuted so they could ask a question directly to Tsipora rather than putting it in the chat box, now is a good time to do it. Again, in the middle of the chat area, midway down the screen, on the left-hand side is a hand. If you click on the hand icon, Betsy will unmute you and you can ask your question. Okay, it looks like Tsipora, your presentation answered people's questions. I'm going to repeat this because as a classroom teacher, I remember taking this issue so seriously, and there were resources, but I didn't always know how to implement them, and I really feel like you've given people so many tools tonight, not just the strategies, but how to implement them successfully, and I really thank you for that.
You're so welcome.